angered mostly with you is that you spend so much of your energy, like, on boycotting businesses downtown and on, like, making big scenes
in
your bathroom.
Should the businesses that abuse homeless people be patronized?
Nobody. You know what? You know what you need to do is you need to stop separating the homeless people with the regular people. Because what it is, I mean, we're all citizens.
Yeah, I'll stop doing it.
We're all
citizens.
And everybody
needs to,
like, take
their actions. I'll stop doing it in the stores. When the stores and the shelters and the city council stops that kind of separation, I myself will no longer have to draw attention to it. But if it is happening,
but don't you think by drawing attention the separation occurs?
Well, let me ask you this. In the 1950s in the South, there was a real separation between blacks and whites.
Hey, this is 1950s.
Is that correct? I mean, no, bear with me.
No, of course, we know that's correct.
All right,
correct, obviously,
what happened? Did it help when civil rights activists drew very vivid attention to that separation, to that differential treatment, that blacks got treated very badly?
Of course it did, and Martin Luther King got assassinated.
Yes, he did, and we hopefully, although there's still a lot of segregation and racial discrimination going on, we got some positive consequences out of that kind of exposure.
Okay, let me bring up one point that I want to
do
before.
You
have to get off the phone, I'm sorry,
okay,
because someone here has to use it. But
okay.
There was an issue about the Java House,
yes,
and I have to bring up the point that the people that they did not want to take coffee out to, man that, he stole bikes. He stole my bike. He stole my bike, and I caught him.
I didn't.
You know what happened? He had enough guts. He actually lived on the same, or he was going to his friend's house on the same street that I lived on, and I caught him. I caught him on my bike, and I got my bike back. So, of course, they shouldn't sell coffee to the bike thief that he's been out there stealing bikes from.
Nope.
You know, so why are you making a big issue
of
that?
Well, the issue was, if there's a man on the sidewalk, I mean, even if he's a murderer, if a couple goes into a store to buy that man a cup of coffee, they're going to throw that couple out for buying him a cup of coffee? I mean,
exactly. It's their business. They have the right to do it. They don't want their coffee to go to a murderer or to a bike thief, someone who is dissed on their establishment. They have all the right to do that. And I'll let you go. Peace.
Well, before you go, farewell.
I want to thank that caller for calling in. It takes some courage to call in when you have an opposing point of view. And I encourage all those who take issue with what I have to say, all those who have additional information, and this woman has additional information. She is alleging that Curtis, the man who was sitting on the sidewalk for whom John Leslie bought coffee, was in fact a bike thief. And my claim was that he denied it. I have no idea if he was or not. I hear two stories. Is that enough reason to throw out another couple who are buying this person a cup of coffee, throw them out of the business? And I have to say no. I can't agree with our caller on that issue. But I definitely do commend her spirit. I commend her for calling in. I encourage her to call in again and to further the record on any issue that she feels is being misstated. And I encourage all other callers to do the same. That's what this show is about. We're interested in dialogue here. I have strong opinions. I have clear opinions. My opinions may not be your opinions. So if you disagree with me, or if you agree with me and you have something to add, do call in, because we need your voice here. And here we have another caller.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi there, I just heard that call.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Quite a bit of compassion to turn the other cheek. And it really does require some insight into yourself and the fact that, well, I've had 3 bikes stolen. I've had a lot of things stolen. And does that mean I'm going to press charges and send someone to jail or do something immediately? Well, I don't have that tendency to be violent or to be mean, so I guess I wouldn't do that. But a lot of people feel that they have to protect themselves from feeling hurt by retaliating. And
well, you sound like you are a person. This is Coral, I believe. How are you doing, Coral?
Must be correct.
You didn't show up at Taco Bell, Coral. I've got some tapes for you.
Oh, well, I'll show up, but
yeah, no, but I think your point is well taken. Although, You know, I too get very hurt. If I lose something, if something is stolen from me, I get angry and I get upset. And so I can sympathize with the woman feeling that way. You know, I wanted to inquire more closely whether she had found, when had this man, you know, when was the timetable? When did this actually all happen? And what were the details around this? But she was in a hurry, and so she couldn't talk any longer. But I'm going to encourage her, if she's still listening, to call in, even up until like 10 to 1, which is when the show is going to end, to, you know, elaborate on her point of view. Of course, my concern about the Jada House is not simply this one case. I'm concerned about the eviction of other homeless activists. I myself was evicted from the Jada House, accused of writing graffiti on the bathroom wall. Then they cooked up some more charges that they thought would justify keeping me out. I'm really concerned about keeping public spaces open to everybody, particularly poor people who are likely to get the shaft. And I think that that's my focus on that.
Yeah, to make a general rule to maybe that was just a special reason they had to retaliate by showing an example of not serving someone because it had just happened. But as a general rule,
I think there has to be a policy. As I was telling Skidmark's Bob earlier, of re-examining and fair process in these kinds of decisions by merchants, because otherwise, you know, it produces a lot of resentment. In many cases, unfair decisions are made. It's simply a matter of naked power on the part of the merchants, and it's unhealthy and unjust. And I would like to, and because the issue is not being dealt with by the Downtown Association, because the issue is not being dealt with by the merchants in question, I've brought the issue to Kevin a number of times, and he's not interested. I'm not talking about the issue with John and Leslie, but other evictions, he just doesn't want to deal with it.
Maybe people should just stop watching football on Sundays.
There you go. That could be the answer.
I think that's it.
Anything else you want to add on this subject?
No, I must go.
Alrighty. Well, thank you for calling in.
All right, Rob.
And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have an open phone line, 427-3772. What do you think about the Jada House situation? Are owner Kevin and manager Stuart being unfairly maligned here by myself and other activists? Should a store owner feel perfectly happy to exclude anybody he wants for any reason whatsoever? Is that a good idea here in Santa Cruz? And should other customers support that regardless of the real facts in the case? And should such exclusions continue year after year over a long period of time in individual cases, regardless of maybe a change in the behavior or attitude of the person excluded, or let's say an acknowledgement that the basis for the exclusion was really kind of a personal hostility on the part of the management? And also, what kind of free speech rights have we got here? Should people be excludable if they're reading the Bible and you don't like people reading Bible in, let's say, not allowed, but just reading a book in your store? I mean, is that a justifiable reason for excluding someone if they have a political button on that you don't like? What about a police officer? If you don't like cops, should you be able to exclude cops from cafes? These are serious questions. I say no. I say everybody should be allowed to come and go. And I say that if there is an exclusion, that should be a major question. There should be a fair process for doing that. There should be a re-examination process. There should be a mediation process. That's what this is all about for me. And I encourage people to call in at 427-3772 to discuss this issue. I'm actually working right now on the ballots from the Velvet Venom Awards. I don't know if you were around to call listeners, whoever you are. I guess I'm talking to everybody here. The Velvet Venom Awards was my attempt to get input from the citizenry on which businesses are the worst exploiters and bigots downtown. And I no doubt will be accused by people of being negative in my perspective, and indeed I'm approaching it from the negative point of view. But in a way it's very positive, because all the businesses that aren't mentioned, we have to assume for the moment, at least are not engaging in outrageously bigoted policy. So we can say that perhaps the majority of businesses downtown are not bigoted towards the homeless. Actually, I wouldn't say that. I think that there's a general standing hostility and bigotry and prejudice that is shared by probably most every business downtown. And the way you can see that is in the business support for the anti-homeless downtown ordinances, which were passed in April of 1994 by our very own city council. Laws making it illegal to sit down near a shop. Actually, it was able, initially, as first passed, it was made illegal for you to sit anywhere on the sidewalk downtown, even if you weren't blocking anything. Now it's illegal to sit within 10 feet of a shop, even if you're not blocking anything. So then there was another law making it illegal to ask for a spare change from a seated position, making it illegal to ask for spare change after dark, making it illegal to ask for spare change in a group of two. A series of laws which had nothing to do with abuse, hostility, blocking the sidewalk, intimidation, no. They had to do with innocent behavior that the business people didn't like the look of and figured was maybe hurting their profits. I've always contested that analysis anyway. I think that the recession, the failure to rebuild in Santa Cruz, big holes in the ground, the proximity of cheaper, more kind of nuts and bolts stores and services in Capitola and elsewhere are more to blame or more responsible, if you will, for the lack of business in downtown Santa Cruz, which has been kind of turning into a trinket junket economy down there, trinket and junk, you know, kind of a tourist trade, Carmel type scene, than is any kind of homeless presence or street people presence, for those who like to make those kinds of distinctions, or deadhead presence, whatever. And even, I have to say, even if it were shown that there was a significant intimidation factor in the sense that some people don't like the look of people with the dreads or and find it scandalous that young people with skateboards hang out downtown and don't want to go down there, I wouldn't put this in the same category as folks saying that blacks moving into the neighborhoods are ruining the property values. That was a constant concern, you know, in the 50s. I say this to the callers. And indeed, property values dropped. Well, you know, tough shit. The reality of human rights is more important than the property values of those who own property. And that's my choice. That's my value. That's how I see it. That's how I'll probably continue to see it. At least that's how I hope I will continue to see it. Why don't you see it? 427-3772. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm counting out the ballots for the Velvet Venom Awards. This was I put out a flyer a couple of days ago suggesting a vote on who is the worst business of the year. The Velvet Venom Award, in case you haven't heard of it, reads like this. Vote for the Velvet Venom Awards to distinguish downtown discriminators in the city of Santa Cruz. This year's 1995-96 Not In My Backyard NIMBY nominees include Zanotto's Grocery for abusive treatment of poor and homeless people trying to cash food stamps, sit at outdoor tables, and patronize the store. One low-income shopper won thousands of dollars from a Zanotto's assistant manager in an out-of-court settlement after a physical assault by that employee. Bookshop Santa Cruz for barring peaceful demonstrators and activists opposed to owner Neil Coonerty's sit-near-shop go-to-jail downtown ordinances. Supervisor Marty Wernhout had to move her Monday orientation sessions to another location where all would be able to attend without discrimination. Food Court for harassing a 3-year-old homeless girl who needed to use the restroom and then evicting the father for helping this child use that facility. ID Building for the continued abusive conduct of manager Stuart Martin, who maligned, slandered, evicted, and then assaulted a homeless customer, reportedly saying, "All homeless people steal," and "Call the police. Who do you think they'll believe, you or me?" Java House for throwing out a couple and their young child because they bought a cup of coffee for a forbidden homeless person on the sidewalk outside, and continued a discriminatory ban against other homeless activists. Add any business bigots we've left out. Include your own specific reasons and experiences. Other possible choices include the Downtown Management Corporation for its Downtown Hosts program, Manx for harassment of downtown musician Phil Free, Union Grove Music for sweeping its parking lot and curb area of homeless undesirables. Write in your first, second, and third choices. Results will be announced on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, Monday and Friday, 10 to noon, and make your vote count. Or you can mail in your ballot. Now, if you want a ballot, if you want a copy of this ballot, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833 to make your choice. You don't even need a ballot. You can simply say on the phone which of these businesses you regard as bigot number one and who then is the lesser bigot number two, and then who brings up the rear with bigotry award number three for your vote for this year's Velvet Venom Awards. That is the choice you have at the moment. And what we're going to do now, I think we're actually going to do another tape here. We're going to be giving you another interview. We have an interview with, well, I'd like to play an interview that, we'll begin with an interview with Ed Fry. Ed has a show of his own on Free Radio Santa Cruz, but he's an attorney, one of the few who's concerned with civil rights for the poor as a major issue. Let's hear what Ed has to say in this very recent interview.
Well, hopefully we're on the phone to Ed Fry. Ed, say hi.
Hi.
All right, now let's see if we are on the phone. It's January 4th, 1996. That's kind of hard to say. 96. I'm on the phone with attorney and civil rights activist Ed Fry. Hi, Ed.
Hi.
So, Ed, what's the word in 96? What you will be looking at in terms of local civil rights issues here downtown and in Santa Cruz and in the broader spectrum across the state and the nation?
Well, I can't begin to catalog everything because there are so many issues, so many places where people are getting deprived of rights that it would be impossible for me to run through every possible issue. But the things I'm working on myself have to do with, well, for example, the right to take marijuana for your medicine, since it's well established that it does work and that, you know, people need it, millions of people need it. There's no reason why the president couldn't sign an executive order, which would require his attorney general to begin the process of rescheduling it. And so with one signature, he could really, in effect, bring relief to millions of people. But he's not really interested in health care. He's interested in protecting the health insurance industry, which keeps him in office.
Mm.
That's my take on the whole thing. That's just one issue.
Mm-hmm. Could the city council do something locally in terms of, say, like Berkeley, putting it at the lowest priority for law enforcement here?
Oh, that's just that's kind of just gestures. It's window dressing, you know. I mean, it's a nice gesture to make for a local government, but the real legal authority lies in the state and the federal governments. So there's not much of the local government can do. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the fact that even 77% of the voters in 1992 in this county approved of the medical use of marijuana officially at the ballot box, still it has had no legal impact. It has had certainly a moral impact on the local law enforcement establishment, such that they permit, with knowledge, the providing medical marijuana to patients who know about the clinic downtown.
Mm-hmm. You yourself have at least one client who's facing felony growing charges and is intending to take that to a full jury trial in the courthouse.
January 16th.
January 16th, and that's
Robbie Berlin.
Robbie Berlin, and what are the charges, and what actually will be happening on the 16th?
Well, it's cultivation for sale and possession of some mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but his thing is that he needs it for his own medicine,
mm-hmm.
and he figures, well, if I'm going to grow it for myself, if I have the capability of growing it, and a lot of other patients do not, why should I not grow it for them too?
Mm-hmm.
Which he did. And so the defense is his necessity and the necessity of other patients.
Have you got any reading on the number of cases currently in the local courts around marijuana, or have you had any discussions with other people about specific cases that are currently winding their way through the labyrinth?
No, I don't have any figures, any statistics. I know I've handled a bunch of cases this year, this season, but and most of them were diverted, or some deal was worked out. This is going to be the first real trial. This year, for me.
Has there been any trial in the last 5 years around marijuana issues that you're aware of by other attorneys in this county?
Well, the only other one I'm aware of that has any hope to set any legal precedent is Scott Hager's case, which is now pending in the Court of Appeals. That was a civil case, which we brought for an injunction against the Attorney General and all law enforcement, local law enforcement people, for the right to use medical marijuana. Now, that's going to be coming up for a hearing fairly soon. I haven't got the exact date yet. They haven't notified me of the hearing date, but that should be coming up fairly soon for a hearing and then a decision.
So there really isn't a lot of local coordination in terms of different marijuana defendants either being aware of each other or even to the extent of knowing what the stats are in terms of how much DA time and police time locally is being spent on these victimless so-called drug crimes.
That's right. The district attorney is succeeding in his strategy of picking people off one by one. It's the way it works all across the country. And various attorneys handle various cases. The public defender's case works like a sort of a factory mill. You know, they just take one case after another, but they don't make any noise about it. They just collect their pay for it. It's just a full employment scam for a bunch of lawyers, judges, clerks, bailiffs, jailkeepers, probation officers, and so on.
The dregs, I mean the cream of our society.
Yeah.
So actually it might not be so hard for a civic-minded local group to actually start rounding up information through the court computers on how many drug cases are actually in the courts at any particular time and how much is being spent on that.
Yeah, I don't know how much that would do for the cause, but sure, it could be done.
Information is always useful, and it's nice to know if there's a number of people locally who are facing this stuff, there's always a chance that they might get together and do something, you know.
The statistic that is most moving to me that is that nationwide, although blacks commit only 13% of the drug offenses in this country,
mm-hmm.
of those who are spending time of all drug prisoners behind bars, 74% are black.
So you've also, of course, been pursuing the district attorney, and he's been pursuing you with masses of legal paper.
Yeah, he's been really throwing paper, heavy paper at us in this lawsuit against him, both in the Court of Appeals and the trial court level. That's coming up for hearing in the trial court level, a second summary judgment motion that they've made. The first one was rejected, now they've made a second one. That's coming up for hearing January 12th in Judge Robert Addick's court.
Oh dear, good luck.
Well, I could have disqualified Judge Addick, but I looked around and looked at the alternatives, and then I talked to some other folks.
From bad to worse.
Yeah. Out of the frying pan we'd be, and into the fire, you know, so.
From Artichoke Heart Attic into the court of Barracuda Barton, you never.
Yeah. So our choices were pretty limited. So, and one thing you can say about Rob Addick is he's his own person, and if he thinks that the law is on my side, I think he'll go for our case, even though he used to work with Art Danner.
They all did, most of them.
Yeah.
And those who didn't are even worse, because they have to prove they're tougher than the DAs.
Exactly.
That's McAdams.
Exactly.
Many Faces McAdams, as I've called him.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, a summary judgment motion, for those who don't know, is in fact a judgment which it's a motion to have a previous your whole case against Art Danner, which is that he misappropriated public funds in the Catherine Gardner matter, thrown out, right?
Yeah, because thrown out on the basis of the approval that was given to his actions by the Board of Supervisors in April of this year, or April of 95.
This is an action which he took during election time to kind of hush up potential cocaine scandal.
From March of 94 to July of 94, he paid this woman $35,000 in salary and benefits under the table without any work in exchange from her. She just sat at home collecting this at his orders. And he just didn't want it raised because it would be too embarrassing to him during the election campaign. So he just paid it under the table, didn't tell anybody else at the county what he was doing. It was totally illegal because he was limited really to 5 days of paid leave under the county regulations. And there's also a lot of state law that says you cannot pay a public employee beyond the last day of service.
Plus a Santa Cruz turn of the century court decision.
Exactly, for the widening of River Street. That's why River Street is still so narrow.
Indeed. Darn, darn, darn. Well, you know, skipping to another topic, battling Bob LaMonica, who was behind the recall effort against Art Danner, which got a respectable number of signatures, but of course did not succeed, has recently been pursuing the question of the Masonic plaque in the county building, which some of us have dismissed as a cranky maneuver. Others have taken a more serious view. I talked to a woman yesterday who initially dismissed the whole idea as an insult to everyone's intelligence and a waste of people's time. Mm-hmm. I guess Bob is concerned that having a Masonic plaque in the county courthouse is a violation of the separation of church and state provisions of the First Amendment.
Well, unless they'll allow one by Huff, too. I mean, if they would allow a Huff plaque. Maybe we'd have some equality.
Huff is not clear what the position of the deity, if there is one, is on property
rights. Okay,
right.
So you can still have a plaque.
Yes, we should.
If the Masons can have a plaque, then why not Huff?
I see. Well, so that's not really a question of religious discrimination. It's a question of equal access for all organizations. Is that the issue?
Well, it certainly would be one of mine.
So, but I've also learned that according to this woman has told me that. Well, one of the issues was that when this plaque was put in, it was done through a secret session of the Board of Supervisors at which Tom Black was a major, had major involvement. Have you heard anything about this?
I have no knowledge about that issue at all, except for the fact that there is a plaque there and it is for the Masons.
I see. And the other thing I heard was that the Masons traditionally and still in Santa Cruz are a white kind of...
As fate would have it, we have in the studio, I'm interrupting this tape because of the real facts behind the Masonic plaque, brouhaha, and what session was closed and what wasn't, will be revealed in the next 15 seconds by Bob LaMonica. Bob, what's the story on the plaque?
Okay, the Masonic plaque is on the county building because of three successive minute orders. The first one is December, I believe the date is the 21st, 1965, and that provides provision for the plaque. The next minute order, these are open board meetings, right? The next minute order is April 26, 1966. The local Masonic organization gets the commission to design the plaque. And then on September 20th, 1966, the Board of Supervisors approves the specific language. Okay, three successive minute orders to get it up. There was a dedication ceremony for the new county building, October 21st, I believe it is, 1967, and thereabouts the Masonic plaque goes up.
But none of it was secret at this point.
No, the secret meeting, the covert closed session that I have talked about, happened December 5th of last year. Now, I mounted a challenge to the Masonic plaque. In fact, I announced it really here on free radio on November 29th. I made my first public statement about the Masonic plaque. And then beginning the following Monday, I started to inquire as to how it got there, how it became. It just struck me as such an obvious, blatant conflict of interest. Santa Cruz County Governmental Center, dedicated to freedom and justice for mankind by free and accepted Masons of California, year 1967, visible and readable from the steps of the county courthouse. Give me a break, okay? It has no business being there. It's outrageous. Who will defend the Masonic plaque? Okay, nonetheless, on November 7th, I made contact with my supervisor, Jan Butes, and I made contact with her again. This is on the phone. On November 30th, I talked to Dwight Hurd, the county counsel, there again on the phone. Monday, December 4th, I made three appearances before the Board of Supervisors, including December 5th. I had no idea there was a closed session meeting happening on December 5th.
This was the closed session.
Okay, December 5th, okay. I saw Jan Butes in the hallway the day that I picked up a letter that Dwight Hurd had put together for me, which was supposed to be ready on the 8th. I also saw Dwight Hurd on the 8th when I picked up the two-minute orders from 1966 that I referred to previously. I saw Dwight Hearn in the back of the clerk of the board section, although we didn't talk. Now, on December 11th, when I picked up that letter from Dwight Hearn, Jan Butes was in the hallway. We chatted for 10, 15 minutes. No mention of any closed session meeting regarding the Masonic plaque.
What was the significance of that closed session?
The significance is that a vote was taken and they talked about the Masonic plaque and that my protest was open. across the board totally. Protocol, consistency. And here they have this. Now, let me get to the crucial part here, how I found out about that closed session meeting. In the letter that Dwight Harrell wrote to me about their position on the plaque, there's a statement that says the board's action to continue placement of the plaque. And that's the operative phrase. And I thought about that. I filed a writ of mandate on December 13th, which is going to challenge this plaque in court, really. There's a hearing on January 19th, 8:30, Department 8. But, you know, the board's action to continue placement of the plaque, over the weekend of the 16th, I was reviewing that letter and looked at that statement, and it hit me that there has to be an open reference to any legislative body's action. And I looked through the previous agendas of the board, and I saw this reference, anticipated litigation, and I saw the code. And I went, in fact, to the downtown library, the Santa Cruz Public Library, shortly before closing time, and came to the conclusion that this is what it was. The meeting was closed session. It was listed as anticipated litigation. They don't refer at all to anything about the Masonic plaque. It was never intended to be known. And I found this out from the county council's office. There was no intention of that meeting ever being known. Now, we're talking about a 10-inch by 5-foot plaque, which, for some reason or other, demanded the necessity not only of closed session, but of covert closed session, where it was never meant to be known. Now, after that, I thought that there had to be one of two things. Either Dwight Hur, the county council, was lying, there was no action taken to continue placing the plaque, or there was a closed session, a covert closed session meeting on December 5th. And I called up the following Monday, and I said that to the county council's office. It's either one of two things. Either Dwight Hur is lying, or there was a closed session meeting on the Masonic plaque. And there was a pause on the phone, and the answer came back, yes. I said, okay, I want the documents on that. And I found out through my own research and feedback from county council that there's no way. The reason why you go into closed session is you get around the Brown Act, open public meetings. You get around the Public Records Act. Whatever happened in that meeting is confidential and secret forever.
Of course,
unless somebody comes forward.
What the Supes, of course, will tell you, and what no doubt the county council may have already told you, is that since it was anticipated litigation, they have the right to do it in secret.
As I said, I saw Jan Buttes. We talked three times. I know I made three appearances to the board, and they want to use that excuse that I was making using open session time. It doesn't cut it at all. I used all the protocol the right way. I was being stalled by my supervisor. I talked to Jan Buttes, as I said, and this is crucial. November 7th, November 30th, I saw her, and we talked on November 11th. I spoke to Dwight Hur, the county council, the day before this closed session meeting on December 4th. Now, give me a break. Okay, is this a way to run a government? And if they can do this with a plaque on the county building, imagine what's being done behind the scenes.
Oh, I think they treat people arrogantly in many instances, Bob, and I thank you for clarifying this statement. Give us about two or three minutes more into your hour here so I can have Ms. Shrunick, we have a new guest in the studio. We're going to have to cut short Ed Fry's interview, hopefully to play the rest of it at some future time, because Ms. Shrunick, who's been looking over the Velvet Venom Awards, has apparently done some investigating of his own, has a report on what's been happening downtown. What's been happening, Ms. Shrunick?
Well, I wanted to get on to a couple of these Zanotto's Grocery. Yeah, I see you got seven here. Let's go eight. I'll put one down for that. And Martin again. Yes, Martin.
Stuart Martin of the ID building, the manager of that building, which apparently he abused throughout, castigated, and then shoved a homeless man on the street.
Plus, he tried to run me over one time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I put that on there last time, if we didn't remember what that was, that he actually went out of his way to get very close to me as I jumped onto the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps he was simply showing that he had a certain affection for you.
Oh, I think so. And I think the other night when he was walking underneath the new building they're building up there, I showed some affection, too. I said, watch out. Look like things are going to fall down. Martin.
Perhaps the whole structure of discrimination will fall down. That's what I'd like to see.
But I was almost hoping that it wouldn't be the Velvet Venom, but I think the Rugrat Award for the crying mayor here.
Oh, Mayor Mike, are you calling him Rugrat Rotkin? That's kind of hard to say. And you say you're calling him Rugrat because you believe he's kind of a crybaby on these issues?
Or? Yeah, and we'd like to recall. Is that four R's or what?
Recall Rugrat Rotkin. It does have a certain ring to it. Recall Rugrat Rotkin, a ringing rejection of... of ridiculous rhubarbism. Like it's hard to on short notice. You had separated from the River Street refugees. What's the story behind that?
Well, it seems to me that I've had a lot of things I have to do in town, and I'm really busy right now, and keep sending me further and further away. I can't do these things that I need to do in town.
You're referring to the fact that the New Brighton Beach campers, also called the River Street refugees, the deportees that Mike Rotkin sent off in city buses rather than deal with an open-air campground in the winter in Santa Cruz, which was working, but which the Citizens Committee for the Homeless wanted to close, these New Brighton Beach campers were forced to move again on January 1st out to a much more distant campground for a couple of days and have moved back to New Brighton Beach. I mean, they are indeed moving. That's a little song. You ever remember that song? Reminds me of the song I used to sing at demonstrations in San Francisco, which I will reprise here in a fit of enthusiasm. It goes like this. Roman, keep those homeless roaming. Roman, go hide. Don't try to house and feed them, just jail rob and beat them, drive them back into the night. Drive them here, drive them there, go hide. Yeah!
Well,
I may be accused of blatant exhibitionism, but there you have it.
And I'm hiding because I don't have a bus pass, and I can't get a bus pass for the whole month, and I can't afford it. So obviously, if I have to do everything in town, I might as well be very close to town.
So you're sleeping illegally at night, Mr. Rimmick?
Yes, I am.
Now, at one point, you suggested you might be involved in demonstrations at City Hall. Is that still an option for you?
Unless something changes, I think the donation of $800 is what basically stopped me. As long as some of the people are taken care of, then I don't feel I have to be there. But you know what? There was some more problems down there. I may have to go back to help out.
Now really, I remember I read about that in the papers and actually heard about that from Dragon's Heart Dan Hopkins yesterday. Do you have more you wanted to say about the downtown situation? We are about to end the show because we're kind of nudging into Bob LaMonica's time. His show is coming right up.
No, I'd just like to say, do vote for the Velvet Venom Awards, please.
Yes, we are going to be distributing more ballots. Actually, I'm hoping we can set up a table downtown. One of the purposes of the Velvet Venom Award, I'll give you a special ballot, Ms. Sherman, before you leave, is to get information we do not have, not just your preference as to who's the worst bigoted business downtown. Yes, we do want to know that. But we also want to know the specific experiences you've had, unexaggerated, you know, unvarnished, gussied up, just what happened to you or someone you know at a business downtown where an act of discrimination occurred, with as many specifics as you can. Give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Now, finally, I'd like to make an announcement. I'd like to invite you, Mr. Rimmick, of course, to come to the 3:30 City Council meeting next Tuesday, January 9th, in which your old friends on the Citizens Committee for the Homeless are going to be doing a little panhandling to the City Council, looking for tens of thousands of bucks.
Sounds good to me.
And I invite everybody else to come to that. I also invite people to come to a demonstration tomorrow in San Francisco. I'm actually going to be the recipient of a borrowed car. I'll be able to get up there. I haven't got a car of my own. It's beached in Marina down south. But I'm going to be going to north. And if anybody's interested, give me a call at 423-HUFF. There may be a few spaces. This is a Food Not Bombs demonstration. Finally, tomorrow, Saturday at 11 a.m., Becky Johnson, a community activist, wants me to announce there will be a recall DA Art Danner meeting. You thought it was dead? Well, maybe not. Because people involved in the recall, people who want to be involved in the recall, people who want to recall not merely Rugrat Rotkin, but also Drumhead Art Danner, should get in touch with Bob LaMonica and beat their way to Becky Johnson's house at 11 a.m. You can get instructions by calling Bob, whose phone number is 457-2670. That's 457-2670. Well, as usual, I'm leaving the air without having said everything I wanted to say. I never can. I never will if I could go on forever. I just talk and talk and talk. But don't believe everything you read in the papers, folks. Particularly, don't believe the Metro Santa Cruz story about the Java House. That one was a real ringer, I must say. And I'll go into that at greater length on Monday. You can be on the show on Monday. Show up at Taco Bell on Pacific Avenue, 9:45 in the morning, and I will escort you blindfolded and stuffed in a trunk to the radio station where we will put you in the air, hopefully in one piece. Actually, just kidding around. You want to be on the station, show up at Taco Bell, give me a call at 423-HUFF. This has been Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. You have been listening to a 2.5, actually 3-hour show this time with me, Bathrobes, Piers, Robert Norse, on civil rights for the poor in Santa Cruz. We're going to go out on the last of the Ed Fry interview, and the next voice you hear will probably be that of Battling Bob LaMonica. Actually, he has his own tape queued, so much for Ed Fry. Next time, Ed, we'll go into you. Thank you, and have a pleasant weekend.
How many McPhersons on the Santa Cruz Sentinel editorial board does it take to suppress the story about the victim of the DA's bodily injury car wreck being blood tested and he not?
The case was dismissed for reasons other than probable cause, we believe. And we'll be right back.
I made a promise, as did many others involved with the 95 Dana.
Outside, even if it's a pariah, forbidden person, undesirable transient element.